was the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston and the song I Can Fly, and this is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage. This month I'm saluting gay and lesbian choruses, and it's a multi-part show. On this hour, the focus is the history of that movement in Houston, and I've got two special interviews to help do that. The first is with Andy Mills, who founded the Montrose Singers in 1979 and was with the chorus until 1984. And bringing things up to date, I'll talk with the current director, Dr. Linus Lerner. Along the way, of course, there'll be lots of music and some other goodies. The music I started off with was a hopeful piece called I Can Fly, and it's by one of the most noteworthy composers for gay choruses, Robert Seeley, taken from his work, Metamorphosis. The Gay Men's Chorus did it on their 2009 album, Topsy Turvy, and that's one of the few double disc releases I can think of by any chorus, so they've come a long way. Before I start telling you about the history, I want to play a track from their first album, and it happens to have been written by two of my gay icons, Romanowski and Phillips. It appeared on the chorus's first release, To Friends and to Life, recorded in 1994 in honor of its 15th anniversary. The song is called Love Is All It Takes.
Thank you.
Before I get any further, I want to give a quick timeline for the chorus. It was founded in November of 1979 as the Montrose Singers, and in 1992 the name was changed to the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. In 2005, that expanded into Bayou City Performing Arts, adding the Bayou City Women's Chorus, and along the way several other ensembles, including the Bayou City Chorale, Bayou Rhythms, and Vocalese. So the Gay Men's Chorus is now in its 32nd season, but back to the beginning. In Houston, Andy Mills is a pretty colorful character. In addition to managing for many years a gay bar called Mary's Naturally, which itself was a colorful Houston institution, he took over the gay community's marching band and founded its chorus. And in my interview with him, I jump right into that history. The Montrose Marching Band was founded in early 79, and the reason for that band was to march in the March on Washington later that year in October. After the march, the band pretty much was ready to fold, and you stepped in and took over the band, changed the name to Montrose Symphonic Band, and at the same time started the Montrose Singers.
Yes, within a month of each other about, and I had been a music major in college, majoring in instruments and minoring in voice. But I was the first director to go to the first Montrose Singers meeting, so I got the job.
So it's like, who wants to do it? Step forward, and everybody step back?
Yeah, everybody else step back. And I never had a board of directors. I never had officers. And ruled with an iron fist. You were in my group, and that's the way it was. And if you didn't like that, you could do as you pleased.
How long were you with the Montrose Singers?
Until 84, when my lover got sick.
And roughly through those years, we're talking 79 to 84, how many members were usually in the chorus?
Between 40 and 60, usually around 60.
How were the Montrose Singers received by both the gay community and Houston in general?
Oh, very, very well. We would do two-night performances at the Tower, which was, to my being, one of the best facilities in the city. It seated 900 people. It was right in the middle of the neighborhood. It was so convenient for everybody, because everybody lived in the Montrose back then. And we do two performances, Saturday and Sunday. Our first performance, Ella Fitzgerald had performed there on a Friday night. I had performed with her in 1956 on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I sent a note backstage when she was here saying that I had done that. I knew she wouldn't remember. And could I come back and visit with her? And I got a note back saying yes. And so I went back and we talked for a good half hour and had a lovely time. A charming, charming woman.
You say you performed with her. Were you in the orchestra? Or?
No, I was with the men's chorus at Ohio State University. And there were 40 men in the glee club. And we had a woman pianist. And we toured the East Coast as 40 men and a girl. Unbeknownst to most of them, some of us weren't all boy.
How soon after the Singers started did you start performing at the Tower Theater?
That was our first concert.
Was it like 1980?
Oh, yeah, yes. And I talked to her, and I had taken an ad out for the Montrose Singers on her program, and I told her about it and yada, yada. So she said, do you want to use my piano? And I said, sure. And so she left her extended keyboard, 9-foot, concert Bösendorfer piano, a $90,000 piano for me to use. He said, when you're done with it, call this number and they'll come pick it up. Well, I wanted to take it home.
I've done a lot of studying on the internet to try and see what choruses were first. San Francisco was indeed first. It kind of looked like Los Angeles, New York City, and Seattle followed, and I think Houston might have been fifth. Does that sound likely?
Well, we were all very close together, and we were the five chorus directors that got together in Chicago. Must have been 81.
It was 81.
And formed GALA, the Gay and Lesbian Choruses.
So there were five directors at that meeting?
Yes.
Well, that clinches it. That
and I don't know which order we all were mm-hmm. anymore. I mean, I have slept since that. And the popularity grew rapidly. The last chorus conference I was at was in 2000 in San Jose. There's one every 4 years in a different city around the world. There were 6,000 chorus members from around the world there, and we sang together in the convention center. And a piece of music that the Dallas Turtle Creek Chorale, which I personally think is the best men's chorus in the world, commissioned a piece of work called Sing for the Cure. And we sight-read that with the orchestra, with him conducting. It was premiered in Dallas with Maya Angelou as a narrator. To hear 6,000 voices together at one time is something you can't believe until you are there in it.
I wanted to get your impression of what it means to a member of the chorus to be in a gay chorus.
Well, number one, the friendships. I can't tell you the number of pairs that have met in a chorus, or if a chorus travels or a band travels to another city, you're going to lose a member or two, and you're going to gain a member or two because of love attractions.
Like exchange students.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But sometimes they're permanent.
You must be very proud to see that a chorus you founded has grown into a major performing arts organization.
Oh, I am. I'm, they're my children. There's only, I think, two in the chorus now that were in when I was the director. I'm very pleased that in the programs they always acknowledge me as the founder of the Montrose Singers, now the Gay Men's Chorus. And that makes me feel good.
During your years with the Montrose Singers, is there any one thing that made you the most proud?
There were so many. Any one. The first time the choruses that were in existence went to the gay games in San Francisco, the first gay games. There were 900 of us, and we sang at that. It was the first attempt at combining the gay games with the gay music goings-on. And I'll never forget it. It was great fun.
Probably a comment might be that you might consider that the real start of the gay choral movement.
Very probably, because it showed that there was strength in numbers, number one.
Taking a break from the interview, I am very pleased to insert some very rare musical history. The Montrose Singers did not release any recordings, and remember, in those days, those releases would have been on vinyl, and not too many choruses could afford to do that. But thanks to a tape Andy shared with me, I'm able to give you a song from their first Christmas concert. This was at the Tower Theater in the heart of Montrose, and the year was 1980. Now remember, be a little kind, as this is a 30-year-old tape. You'll hear Andy introduce the song.
This next number, which I
thought looked like an easy round in two parts in August when I was looking for Christmas music. And I brought it and we worked on it. And then Ordinary People came out, and it's the theme music to Ordinary People. This is the only place we can find this piece of music with words. And it's been a great deal of fun and in a tremendous amount of work to work up. It's got to be done with three separate choruses. So I guarantee to start it and stop it. The original name of it is the Pachelbel Canon. To us, it is all peace, all joy.
I would not have normally chosen a 7-minute song, but I really liked that one, and there was about 5 times more applause, but I trimmed it down. Again, that recording was not released and was just privately done for their archives, but I'm delighted to have it and that history to share with you, and you can hear the whole concert on my site. Back to the interview with Andy Mills. I need to interject here for non-Houstonians that the bar called Mary's Naturally was an institution for 39 years until its closing in November of 2009. It was in the heart of Montrose and was always a prime gathering place during the Pride parades, and it would be a huge understatement to say that this was the home of so many stories.
Another big part of your early gay history is working at Mary's.
Yes, the best job I ever had. And Jim Farmer, who owned Mary's, had been a friend of mine for years. So I lived in New York, and he would come to New York to visit. And I was in there one day, and he said, "Could you bartend for a couple of days because I'm shorthanded?" I said, "Sure." And so I went to work, and one night I went to the office at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there's the manager on a couch with a trick, and there's money all over the office. And so I called Jim at home, and I said, "Come over here now." He said, "I'm asleep." I said, "I don't care. Come over here now." He came over, came up, and I said, "I want you to get rid of him and him. And I am your new manager." And I collected like $40,000 that was scattered throughout the office. And I cleaned everything up. This was before the band or the chorus. This was like 76. And then in 79, when I went to, unbeknownst to me, take over the chorus, and we had no piano, so he had a Steinway grand piano, and I said, I need your piano. So we moved it to that place where we were rehearsing. And as long as he got the money he needed to do what he wanted to do, I could do whatever I wanted with the rest of it, as far as the community was concerned. I could donate to, I could buy, go to auctions, whatever. It didn't matter to him. And so I started the chorus, and I went to the music store and bought music and wrote Mary's check for it. I signed all the checks.
So one of the oldest gay bars in Texas funded the band in the chorus.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Probably $80,000 for the band when I started buying timpani and chimes and music stands and concert uniforms, music for the chorus. You buy one piece of music for 60 cents and you've got enough for the whole chorus. For the band, one arrangement of one piece of music is at least $90. Every song was another $90 or more. So to do an hour and a half worth of music, you had $700-$800 in it. So in between that and instruments, it's a much more expensive. That's why there's only like 20 bands in the United States.
Gay bands.
Yeah. Compared to over 100 choruses.
The last question I have written down, we might get some more stuff, that is, any amusing stories about the Montrose Singers?
Every rehearsal was an amusing story. The most amusing story about a performance was at Cullen Theater at the University of Houston. And I was funny about comic stuff. I was interested in doing concerts, like professional show stuff, not camp, yada yada. I just didn't do it. And it wasn't done back in the early 80s like it's done now. Every chorus has much camp and carry on and rainbowed hats and umbrellas and fans
and dancing and
we didn't have any of that before, and we're singing, and one of the chorus members came out with this probably 3-foot hamper as big around as a barrel, and we are singing a slow drag from Tremonitia, which is a Scott Joplin opera. And it had been performed less than a year before at Miller Outdoor Theater by the Houston Grand Opera. So it was fresh in people's minds. And as we're singing, they go to the hamper one at a time and pull out a dress and a wig. There's nothing I can do to stop it. It's in the go. And so we continued to sing, and the audience thought it was hysterical, and thank God, and I was dumbstruck. I don't like surprises when I've got my back to an audience. And after that number, we went into a medley of tunes from South Pacific. Well, you should have heard the audience when someone chanted Evening. And I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. All these songs came up with all of these men in drag. Well, it was hysterical.
Did you give them hell for doing that?
No, it was such a success. No, there was no point.
And how cool is this? I have a recording of one of the songs from that concert that Andy was just describing, from a tape made just for chorus use from the Gay Pride Week concert in 1982. Remember, the chorus had just changed into drag before the helpless Andy, and here's him introducing the next set, starting with Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair.
We're going to do selections this evening. That I arranged in midwinter from South Pacific.
Again, Andy Mills was with the chorus until 1984. Before it changed its name in 1992, it was involved in some politics and homophobia. In September of 1991, it rented some space for a concert at the Catholic school, St. Thomas University. But then the university canceled the concert, as it said it had gotten complaints from alumni and students who did not want visible homosexuals on the campus. The political action group Queer Nation organized a sing-in protest at the campus, and the chorus found other space for its concert at Rice University. You can find a clip of the news coverage of that protest on YouTube. As far as the recordings of the Bayou City Arts choruses go, they really got into full steam when James Knapp was director from 2001 to 2009, with six releases coming out. A mostly holiday CD, Grateful, was first in 2003, and from it, from the musical The Wiz, is Home.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home, I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing. When that makes the time.
Was from their 2003 release, to be followed by Red Hot and Cole, as in Cole Porter, the next year. From that recording is Every Time I Say Goodbye.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why a little, why the gods above me who must be so little of
Of course, that was Elton John's song, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, which the Gay Men's Chorus included on their 2005 release, Mosaic. As part of my research for this show, on October 4th, I attended a rehearsal of the Gay Men's Chorus, and seeing Dr. Linus Lerner in action was very impressive. He has an amazing enthusiasm, and I can see how he spreads that to the chorus members. This is his second season as artistic director, and this was a Monday, so this was the men's chorus. The Bayou City women's chorus members get their turns on Tuesdays. That night, I had my laptop with me for the interview, and I turned its recorder on for part of the rehearsal. I'm sure they would want me to remind that this was an early rehearsal for this year's holiday concert. While I was there that evening, I talked with several members and decided I wanted to get some comments from a couple of them, sort of voices from the trenches. I spoke first with Richard Hutkins.
Why did you join the chorus?
Because the rest of my time during the week was all spent kind of in the heterosexual world. It was my one outlet to feel like I was participating within my own community.
How long have you been a member?
I actually joined the Montrose Singers 30 years ago and sang for about 2 years. And then I left that group and went with another choral group and then rejoined the Gay Men's Chorus, which the Montrose Singers eventually became, about 9 years ago.
And what do you see as the goals of a gay and lesbian chorus?
The mission statement for the Houston Gay Men's Chorus is to provide excellence in music and provide a nurturing environment for its members. And I think that holds true pretty much across the board.
Do you think the emphasis on any of these goals has changed over the years?
I think the changes that have happened are the results of what's happened in our culture, and not our culture, but the American culture in the last several years, where music programs have been cut out of high schools, and choral music is now something that young people think of as outdated. So I think the gala choruses are struggling to meet the challenge of how do you re-excite the community about attending chorus performances. The show on television, Glee, shows a lot of bigotry within the school system against a chorus in the school, just because it's not the end thing to do. And I think that same impact is occurring just to choruses in general.
Very good. Anything I should ask you that I haven't asked you that you'd like to comment on?
Well, there were a lot of, not a lot, but there were a number of gay composers who wrote pieces of music, particularly during the height of the AIDS epidemic, when so many of the gays in the community were dying before meds were available. And they would write pieces of music that would generally take up half of a concert. It was all music of the sorrow and the pain and of dealing with AIDS, of being discriminated against. Also, what I heard from members of the audience, they were tired of attending concerts that they walked out feeling emotionally drained, and they want to be entertained right now. And there's been a change. Linus said, we're not going to go out and sing kumbaya anymore. We're moving past that. We are gay, we're here, and we don't need to do that anymore. We don't need to stay focused in the struggle of the gay people. Just give good performances and continue to survive and appear and become a well-known musical group and accepted within the city as a whole is a real accomplishment.
Kind of a visibility with excellence?
Right, absolutely.
And I also spoke with longtime chorus member David Gibo.
How long have you been a member of the chorus?
Since September of 1993.
And there were probably other choruses you could have joined. Why did you join the Gay Men's Chorus?
Because it was called the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. It was identified as a gay organization.
And what has being a member meant to you over the years?
I think when I was a kid, I would have loved to have seen an organization of people in performance who claimed who they were outright and were proud of it and willing to stand on a stage and sing about it. And I know that being part of this organization has changed people's lives. And that's the best part, is that I think it gives people the chance to know that, yes, you too can be out and proud and you can all be good.
Has what it means to you changed over the years?
Not really. It's grown richer because, you know, I've gotten to meet people, gay and straight alike, who have really been moved by what we have to say and what we're able to accomplish and what we're trying to do. I mean, we're technically not a political organization. It's really about the music, and music is a universal language. And to hear the validation that how much people have enjoyed our shows and really seem to get what we're doing, it has been very gratifying. You know, this is my 18th season with this group, and it's something that I have to do. I enjoy singing so much, and I love this group.
What do you see as the future of gay choruses?
I would like to see gay choruses with a lot more outreach, not just confined to the gay and lesbian culture, but to be as inclusive as we want the world to be as inclusive of us. So have us perform concerts for anybody to see, and I think that's where we're moving to.
After the rehearsal, I sat down with Dr. Lerner for our interview. Tell me a little about your background.
I'm from Brazil, where I, you know, was a conductor since I was 18. I also played the guitar since I was 13. Had an orchestra of guitars in Brazil. 18, I started conducting. At 22, I sang my first opera as a baritone. And age 27, I was singing opera professionally and conducting a lot of choruses and some instrumental groups. And then when I came to the United States from a competition that I did there, both singing and conducting, and then I came to the United States, I have a master's degree at the College Conservatory of Cincinnati. Then I decided to do another master's degree in orchestral conducting at Florida State. And then after that, I did a doctoral degree in conducting, specializing in opera at the University of Arizona. But all this time, keep conducting and working with choruses and other instrumental groups that singing and coaching all over the world right now. So basically 24 years of experience conducting chorus now, and about 20 years singing and so on.
And how did you get to your position in Houston?
I had a gay chorus which became a men's chorus with a beautiful mission to work, you know, to help people with HIV in Tucson, Arizona, where I was doing my doctoral degree. Once I finished that, I was looking to leave, and they made me stay another 2 years. They gave me a green card, and I bought a house there. But then, you know, I thought, I still want to go to a bigger city. The opportunity appeared here, and here I am. This is my second year, my second season with the chorus, and I'm already very involved with other aspects of the community.
So this is your second gay chorus,
yeah,
right? What was the name of that chorus?
Reveille, first Reveille Gay Men's Chorus, and now Reveille Men's Chorus.
So tell me about the first one and how this experience is different from that one.
The first gay chorus is started about 8 years ago, so I worked with them for probably 6 years or so. It was actually, I was still in the school, and a friend of mine said, Linus, there's this position opening with a gay chorus. And I was like, what is a gay chorus anyway? I didn't have that idea. Being a Brazilian, we don't have gay chorus in Brazil. So I thought, well, let me go and try and see what I can do, because I do have experience with choruses. And ended up being a very interesting one because, you know, just male voices. I did that in Brazil a lot, and also did female voices. So I was excited with the sound. It was a small group, was very intense because every voice really counts more than anything else. I mean, here too, but it's easy to get lost your voice when you have 70 or 100 people. So with 20 some singers, you know, everybody needs to know very well what they're doing. So when we went to Gala Festival in Montreal and also in Miami, people really like the chorus, the sound. We actually have 25 people and we sound like 50. Had a big sound. And that one of the things that brought the attention for me to come to Houston, because some members of this chorus saw me conducting and they said, we gotta bring this guy here. So they invited me to apply. And there you go. Like, one reason is to work with a bigger chorus. Right now, as I mentioned tonight at the rehearsal, we have about 70 some members. And that's like three times the size that I have in Tucson. And I always like that. And same with the women that I work, they have 52 singers now. So it's a big growth from last year, from 50 to 70 some. And we're still receiving, I mean, we had a new member tonight. So the difference is size. Quality-wise, this chorus has 30 years of history. In Tucson, the chorus have about 16 years now. You know, and we can do better, bigger projects here with more of a bigger community. I mean, Houston is such a big city that so many opportunities.
For some people, there's an issue of whether or not a gay chorus should have the word gay in their title. And there are various reasons, pro or con. How do you feel about that?
I honestly don't like labeling, but I understand the reasons that people that believe we should keep gay. I mean, as you see all this bullying, all these kids killing themselves is still there. We need to do something. And as I always say, you know, Tucson is very, very proactive, very open mind, much more than Texas. I mean, we are in Texas. It's a very more difficult community to understand those issues or to accept for just the history. So I think here the gay name, the gay part of the name is still has so much to do until we actually can drop that. But you know, it's a debate. Some people will disagree with me in either way, because I really don't have a strong position right now. I just let it be. I took the chorus here as the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. I'm not gonna change, because I know I will create a big problem right there. Actually, I hope that in the future we don't need gay choruses anymore. We don't even need to mention anything like that, because now you can be gay anywhere. In the past, gay choruses exist so that you can find safety. You can feel comfortable in a sort of family setting, in a community.
Given that, what do you see as the role of a gay chorus?
Right now is to bring a good image of the gay community, and more is growing the idea that we can just be a good chorus, that we can sing great music and put a show for entertainment. I believe that a lot of people are coming to our shows these days because it's fun to watch grown-up boys doing a show. It's a whole package, but entertainment is obviously a big deal that people come to see us.
Has there been any thoughts to organizing a gay youth chorus in Houston?
There is. In fact, BCPA now is engaging other groups. We might next year have the Pride Band joining us, maybe part of BCPA, and that's the next step. After that, we are thinking about a youth chorus. We are even thinking about a men's chorus, and we're thinking about an orchestra. If we keep growing Bayou City Performing Arts as representative of community arts without labeling and just being GLBT, we're going to be adding different groups. And then it makes even more a statement true about diversity, because we are not saying that we just work with gays. I mean, that's LGBT per se. You know, we're already the women's chorus is not a lesbian chorus. It's called Bayou City Women's Chorus because it's mixed. And I really don't even know who is lesbian, who is not, because it's not part of our agenda. But I know from what they tell me that it's pretty much 50-50. And I think that's really beautiful when we don't care about that anymore, at least within our own group.
Is there networking done between other gay choruses, or should there be more? Or
this chorus has been done things with both, I think, Austin and maybe San Antonio as well, and probably we gonna do something with Dallas, you know, the Turtle Creek Chorale. I think they've done before.
When I was thinking of networking, I wasn't thinking of just performing together. I was thinking of communicating and maybe exchanging material, or here's this great song. And
oh, yeah, that's why gala festivals, gala happens all the time. We just had one in Dallas. There was a leadership conference that brings all the conductors of the gala choruses all the country, and they do that. They'd exchange music. They think about, you know, how can we contribute to each other. So that is happening through Gala Corporation, Gala Choruses Inc., which is representative of all the GLBT choruses in the country. So I think it's in pretty good shape. Gala is doing a great job on that.
Without naming any chorus you've personally been involved with, what do you think are the best gay choruses in the United States?
I think is probably still the Turtle Creek Chorale in Dallas. They have so much history. They have a lot of members. They have a very good sound that Tim Zilik worked so many years. And I think that is one of the best, if not the best. Now, for example, Seattle is the biggest community chorus in the world. But when I hear them in the last gala, I mean, it was this huge group of people singing, and yet I almost have more sound with my 25 people in Tucson than 200 that was on stage or 150 that was on stage from Seattle, because, you know, sometimes it's so many people, it's not as easy to work. It's easy to have a result that, you know, so many people singing, but you can work so much in sound. As you know, with a certain size of groups, so it's really hard. I mean, and we're not there to compete, but I think Turtle Creek is a big chorus, and there's plenty of small groups that are absolutely amazing. San Francisco Golden Gate Chorale, it's one of them. It's just absolutely out of this world.
What's the biggest challenge for a gay chorus?
The biggest challenge for a gay chorus these days is membership. I mean, everybody's busy. A lot of groups are losing members again because I think it's not as such a safe place anymore. You can be gay any other places. So they don't need to be in a gay chorus to be out. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. The other challenges is that we are going artistically wise to sort of down the hill. No more educations in the schools. No preparation, so we get, you know, not so well prepared people. The choral community, it's not so engaged as they used to be in the past, although it's still the biggest type of community music making in the country and probably in the world. Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is money, because to put a show, you need a lot of money, and there's not much money out there, and people that are giving, you know, people that give to an opera, people that give to an orchestra, don't give to a gay chorus, you know, are still giving, but even those big donors are not giving as much. So yeah, I think you need to work hard, money in any aspects, principally because it's a community group, and if people don't feel the necessity of a gay chorus anymore, then they don't want to give for that. It's like, what's the point? As a lot of people ask, what's the point to give to gay chorus now? You know, you can be gay anywhere.
One of your members I was talking to this evening commented that he thought Turtle Creek got more sponsorship because they didn't have gay in their name.
Oh, absolutely. That is obvious. We got some grants here as the Gay Men Squirrels of Houston, of institutions that give because we have the gay, so they can say we support. But then they go, if they give us $5,000, they go and give $50 to another group that will be, the whole purpose is to be against the whole gay issue. So they want to be there saying, we are supporting you guys, but they are not. If you think about it, they will give away much more money to go against us. And there's plenty of groups that do that. Now, when you don't have the gay attached to it, then, you know, they're giving to the arts or whatever because the gay issue is not there. Normally, you know, some of corporations that give money, they don't really come to the shows. They just support and they don't care how gay is or how gay theme is that show. They will just give. One reason we create BCPA here is so that we could also have that people that want to donate but are afraid of donate to something related to gay, but they want to donate. I mean, that's the reality of the beast.
Any question I should ask I didn't ask?
Well, just to make it very clear, I always tell my parents I'm gay, I'm very proud, and I brought that idea here so we get out of that excusing ourselves. I'm very proud. I tell my parents that if I was to be born again for the next 10 times, please, I want to be gay as it gets, because I got the best from my life for being gay, and I'm very happy about it, and I think my life wouldn't be nearly as fun, interesting, and engaging, and changing the world if I wasn't gay. I totally agree on that, but I also think that because I don't make a big issue of it, like I have an orchestra that I totally think it's cool that they never brought that issue. You know, I was the gay conductor in the city when I got the job, over 79 people from all over the world. And to show that people don't care about this anymore as they used to. I mean, they are accepting. But if I go out there and show that I don't really make a big deal, that I'm just who I am, then people will accept even better. But I need that people to understand that I'm not excusing myself for being gay, but much to the opposite, I am proud and happy. But I don't also have to go in the face of people and say, look, I am gay and you are not. I mean, I am who I am. And in that matter, yeah, gay is great. As my mom says to me, you know, gay is cool, gay is fashion, everybody's gay these days.
The Bayou City Women's Chorus was formed in 2005 and has grown to about 70 members, and it's appeared on 3 of the CDs so far: Uncommon Reflections in 2007, Topsy Turvy, and Winter Light in 2009. Two songs from those recordings by the Women's Chorus are Ordinary Miracles and, from the musical Chorus Line, the song One.
Raindrops make a sea, one day at a time.
Yes, she's the one. And this is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and I thank Andy Mills, Linus Lerner, and chorus members Richard Hutkins and David Gibo for their interviews for this segment, and I thank you for listening. It was hard to pick what songs to include, as I had 7 CDs to pick from, making the choice for closing song all the more difficult. But I think a logical choice is one from the 2009 album Topsy Turvy. This was a 2-CD set which included all of the groups under the Bayou City Performing Arts umbrella, and there's a combination on it I have not played yet on this show. This is both the Gay Men's Chorus and the Bayou City Women's Chorus singing together, under the name Bayou City Chorale. And the song is a Holly Near anthem called The Great Peace March.